Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Today on Garden Talk, we'll be taking a look at companion planting. Jessica Walliser is with us, back with us. She's a horticulturist and author, a former contributing editor for Organic Gardening magazine, and a regular contributor to Fine Gardening, Urban Farm, and Hobby Farms magazines. She blogs from both SavvyGardening.com and HobbyFarms.com. I'm going to talk with her about her new book. It's titled Plant Partners, Science-Based Companion Planting Strategies for the Vegetable Garden. And I hope you'll join in if you tried companion planting. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And again, we'd love to hear from you. Jessica Walliser, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Hey, Larry. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's nice to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. How did you get into researching companion planting?
Well, I guess I put my nerd hat on because I do love to research. I love to sort of dive into the science behind gardening, you know, as a horticulturist. I've always had that sort of background. And, you know, people have been talking about and practicing companion planting for generations. And but yet it also has this reputation of really being based in folklore and sort of these traditional practices. But they're, you know, always seemed like there was very little science to back it up. But again, as a horticulturist, I kept saying, well, listen, I know that plants interact with each other. I know they interact with the organisms in the soil. And so that said to me, like, well, there has to be some scientific legitimacy to partnering plants to get certain benefits. And so I started to look at what that science is. You know, does it actually exist? Is it more than folklore based? And what I found was that there were, you know, loads of research projects that took place at university facilities, at agricultural research centers around the country and around the world. And what I started to do was collect all of those studies and look at them and look at how they might, you know, the practices that they talked about, how they might impart a positive result in our own home vegetable gardens. And that's really the genesis of the book. It was really fun. It was a lot of work, but it was really fun to put together.
Yeah, and it's a fun book to go through as well. You've done a really nice job with it. What's actually the history behind planting certain plants together? I mean, this go way back?
It does, yeah. And like I said, a lot of it is just sort of you know, kind of folklore based. I mean, there was years ago, well, a long time ago, there was sort of this movement to look at what plants looked like under a microscope, what the kind of crystalline structure of them was under a microscope. And so early companion planting enthusiasts would look at, you know, what their crystalline structure looked like. And they would say, oh, well, this one, the crystalline structure of this plant looks a lot like the crystalline structure of that plant. So we should put the two of them together because they must like each other, right? Or the crystalline structure was different. So they said, okay, well, these two must not like each other. So they must not be planted anywhere together. And we've certainly come a long way since then because we're doing the actual scientific research behind it now. You know, the part that might be hard for some gardeners who have been practicing companion planting for years is that some of the most sort of beloved plant combinations that people plant together, there isn't science to back those up. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't put them next to each other in the garden. That's not the case. But it's just, you know, is the science there for that partnership? And in some cases, it's not. And that part might disappoint some people. But there's lots of other combinations that do have the science to back them up. And that's what's really exciting.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, and, you know, maybe we should just talk about the benefits of companion planting. We haven't really, you know, really just gone into that. So what do you think are the biggest benefits of companion planting?
Yeah, there's lots, actually. And one of the things that I discovered, again, through researching for plant partners, is that there's really, we can kind of categorize them into seven different possible benefits. Probably the one that people are most familiar with companion planting is for pest control, where they think that, you know, one plant is going to, you know, deter a pest. And that's one aspect, although the, sort of the science behind that is a little bit interesting as well. But so we do have pest management. We have companion planting for soil preparation and conditioning. And that's things like, you know, using cover crops to help amend the soil, using leguminous crops to add nitrogen to the soil. We have weed management. We can partner plants together to help manage weeds. We've got disease management. There's certain combinations of plants that have been shown to deter particular diseases. We have the enhancement of biological control as a possible benefit, which means we're attracting the beneficial insects that will help us, you know, control the pest insects, usually by eating them. We have pollination. So we can partner plants in the garden to help attract certain pollinators into the landscape. And that's a really fun and creative way to use companion planting, too.
And those are all areas, almost sub headings in your book, as a matter of fact. Those
they are. Yeah, that's how I divided it. Yep, that's how I divided it. We have seven chapters throughout. And the one I didn't mention is the only chapter in the book that isn't based purely on research. And that is using a companion plant to support, like a physical support, a structural support. So like in the Three Sisters, which is sort of like the, among the most famous companion planting partnerships, which is corn with pole beans growing up it and then squash growing on the ground beneath. Well, the corn serves as a structure for the pole beans to climb. So one chapter in the book is dedicated to those kinds of partnerships. There's not science to back them up. That's kind of more of an aesthetic chapter. So I did break my own rule in that chapter, but the other six are all based on research.
I like that chapter. I'm glad you put it in. Well, let's talk about some of the, well, are there downsides to the method, the companion planting method?
There are. And doesn't that come with everything about gardening, right? Even when we're doing something right, we're following all the guidelines, there still can be some negative effects. And that's certainly the case with companion planting. I think one of the biggest possible negatives is competition, because plants do compete. They compete for resources like water, mineral nutrition, certainly sunlight as well. And so when we have that plants placed closely together, sometimes we might end up with a little bit of negative effects due to competition. So that's certainly a possibility. But in most cases, if it's a well-studied plant partnership and you're employing it in the garden correctly, the positives are going to outweigh the negatives. The other negative is, especially in the chapter on soil preparation, where we're talking about cover crops and using those in the garden, possible negative there is if you don't use the cover crops correctly or you choose the wrong one, they could end up becoming weedy in the garden. So I do spend a good amount of time in Plant Partners talking about how, as a home gardener, do you properly use cover crops? How do you pick the right one? How do you prevent them from going to seed and taking over the garden? Because it's a really valuable practice, but it has to be done correctly.
Yeah. I noted in your book that you say the question you are most often asked, I think, is how close do I have to have my plants together to be for them to be considered companions? And I think you say it depends.
It does depend. It depends on a lot. You know, the kind of old school thinking of companion planting is that plant A has to go with plant B and they have to be planted right next to each other. But the truth is there's a lot of plant partnerships where it's a succession. So, you know, this plant goes into the ground, you know, maybe a couple of months before the other plant does, so that we can get the positive effects of that. So they don't necessarily have to be in the same space at the same time. But we do want to, and again, it does really depend on what specific partnership and what benefit that we're seeking.
Let's talk about living mulches for a minute or two, and maybe you could expand on what living mulches actually do, what they are and what they do.
Sure. So living mulch is using one plant that's very low growing around the base or over the soil beneath other plants. And so instead of putting down like shredded leaves or, you know, a thick layer of straw in your garden, you're actually using a plant, a living plant, to serve as a mulch, which will help protect the soil from erosion. It stabilizes the soil temperatures. It can, if we choose the right one, add maybe nitrogen or other nutrients into the soil. It's really a great and effective method for gaining a lot of benefits in the garden, and in particular, weed management. Because if something is growing there in terms of it being a living mulch, then there's less room for the weeds to move in. And it actually can shade this. The living mulch will help shade the soil and prevent weed seed germination as well. It's a good practice. It, again, though, it does come with caveats. I mean, you have to do it correctly in order to gain the most benefits and not have it become problematic. So, you know, in that chapter in the book, I talk about how if you're growing a perennial crop like blueberries or raspberries or kiwi vines or something like that, if it's a perennial crop, then you are best using a perennial living mulch, like maybe white Dutch clover. If you're growing annual crops like your tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and okra, then you want to choose an annual living mulch, something that's going to die over the winter. So that might be something like a crop of oats underneath, or crimson clover, or subterranean clover, which is going to, especially in Wisconsin, they're going to die over the winter. So you're getting the benefits without the risk of that competing and becoming problematic in the garden.
Yeah. Speaking of covers, Laura and Coleman, now this isn't strictly for the garden, but she has some cedar trees that where the deer have eaten out a lot of the lower branches, and wondering about a ground cover that you might put under cedar trees, maybe a living mulch kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, you know, you're talking about an ornamental planting. So with an ornamental planting like that, I would call it, you know, a ground cover. You're using a ground cover in there, and that might be something like epimedium or pachysandra. So that to me is the difference between a living mulch and a simple ground cover. So the ground cover is more sort of for its ornamental purpose, where a living mulch is planted usually in the vegetable garden under edible crops. And it's, you know, eventually you're going to mow it. So it's going to be released, you know, break down within the soil. So it kind of serves a different purpose in the garden. But certainly under a cedar tree like that, there's lots of ground covers that do enjoy being in the shade. And again, I pointed to epimedium. I also might say ginger, like European ginger, which is a great low-growing ground cover that would work in that situation too.
Talking today with Jessica Walliser about her new book. It's a cool book. It's called Plant Partners. That's the title. The subtitle is Science-Based Companion Planting Strategies for the Vegetable Garden. Vegetable garden questions or other gardening questions for her, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at Plant Partners. That's the title of the book written by Jessica Walliser, Science-Based Companion Planting Strategies for the Vegetable Garden. Great to have her with us. Again, if you want to join in with your own questions, I hope you will, or maybe your own experiences. Have you done some companion planting? What kinds of successes have you had? Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, and the email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And we have a caller online, Melanie in Stevens Point. Melanie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been putting the question out there to, you know, Facebook and my friends and any resources that I can, looking for just a database where I can access and filter out my zone that I'm in, the plants I'm looking for, the soil I have, and just kind of streamline it down to exactly what's available, what my choices are. Is there such a thing out there?
Hmm. What do you think, Jessica?
I think that's a great question, and I think that would be an incredible resource for gardeners to have. I would suggest maybe reaching out to your state's extension service, a cooperative extension service. They have a lot of resources and on hand, a lot of pamphlets, a lot of materials, and they usually have, they might all be separate resources, though. Like, I don't know anybody that puts all that together into a single database, but they would have, you know, here's the best plants that are native to your climate. Here's the, you know, the soil conditions and what you might need to do to amend them. You know, here's more condition or more information on planting times for our zone. So you might have to be the one to collect all that together, but usually our extension services will have those resources separately available to gardeners.
Yeah, and if you, Melanie, if you go online to the UW Learning Store or University of Wisconsin Learning Store, that is it's exactly what Jessica's talking about. There's a whole plethora of publications and fact sheets and bulletins that are designed for the gardener. And so you can do some searches on, let's say you want to grow, I don't know, just say tomatoes. If it's tomatoes in Stevens Point, you're going to get some recommendations through the publications. One of them is called Growing Tomatoes in Wisconsin that lists varieties that are specific to different regions of the state. Now, it may not get down to, it's not going to get down to maybe your exact soil type, but if you know your soil and you've had a soil test to check it, you're going to be able to, I think, pretty well match that up through the Learning Store. And the Horticulture Department also has, at UW, also has a listing of publications that you could look at. So I hope you'll do that. Take Jessica's advice and maybe go to the UW Learning Store and see what you can find there. Let's take another call. Bob in Medford, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi, Larry.
What can we do for you today?
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in growing some grapes this year for wine production, and it's my first time around. My question is there a recommended ground cover, if any? And if so, what would that tend to do to the soil characteristics?
Hmm.
Yep. So for me, I would, you know, hands down recommend a flowering living mulch for underneath your grapevine. So something like Crimson Clover is one that has actually had quite a bit of studies looking at it, where you're partnering those plants together, and it works beautifully because it does provide nitrogen to the grapes. It's very easy to mow, so you can plant it in between your rows of grapes and then just, you know, every now and then just mow down that line. White clover would also work well, like white Dutch clover. Same benefits out of that one as well, and they would be great choices for underneath grapevines. And then you have the flowers, right, which improves the pollination.
Yeah.
You get the beneficial insects in there. It creates habitat for the ladybugs and ground beetles and lacewings and all the other insects that will help you control pests on the grapes.
Yeah, and for I would just add in there, just because I have the Learning Store on my mind at the moment, there's a great publication from UW Extension titled Growing Grapes in Wisconsin. And, you know, gets into a lot of the practices, the things you need to do to keep your vines, you know, to take care of your vines and other horticultural practices relating to grapes. So it's another publication that you might want to take a look at, Bob. And you can just, again, get it at UW Learning Store, Growing Grapes in Wisconsin. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. What gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call. A listener emailed to ask if there's a plant partner you recommend for under apple trees in a home orchard to avoid using chemicals.
Yeah, that's great. So again, lots of research looking at, you know, rather than having grass underneath your apple trees or other fruit trees, about having a mixed habitat, because diversity is always a key to stability in the garden and certainly in the orchard as well. We want to have some flowering plants under there that are going to provide, you know, early season nectar for those plants. So they're going to help provide pollination to the apple trees as well. So you can do, they actually sell mixes, like wildflower mixes that you could plant under there. You definitely could do a cover crop of something like buckwheat, or any one of the clovers would work in that situation, like a white clover, which is a perennial, or, you know, crimson clover, subterranean. So any one of those would work really well. In a large area, I actually suggest mixing. So rather than just going with one particular species of plants in an orchard like that, you might want to go with a collection of different plants, so that if one, you know, doesn't have such a good year, you've got another one to kind of take over the game for it, so to speak, right? So, and again, we've got a diversity of different flower types and different plant structures, and that's really, really good habitat for all the good bugs.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that question. Barbara in Middleton emailed to ask if she can use her winter interest plants, turtle heads, anise, hyssop, as mulch in her garden if it's cut into small pieces. And she mentions, by the way, Jessica, you have wonderful plant reference books.
Oh, well, that's very nice of her. So I'm not quite sure exactly what she's talking about. She's talking about using the trimmings and the clippings from those plants as a mulch?
I think she may be just talking about the, you know, if you leave them out over the winter, you've got all the dead plant materials left. And could she take those plant materials and put them in the garden as a kind of a mulch?
I see. Yeah. So I'm a big proponent of allowing your garden to stand through the winter rather than doing a fall cleanup. Do your cleanup in the spring after we have temperatures, a week's worth of temperatures above 50 degrees, daytime temperatures. That, because all of these good insects that help our gardens, they all need a place to overwinter. And that's where they overwinter. They overwinter in leaf debris, in hollow plant stems. They tuck themselves in a little node of a standing perennial or an ornamental grass. So we need to leave those stand in the winter and then do the cleanup in the spring. So if you choose to, when you cut down your plants in the spring, if you want to let those trimmings lie in the garden, you certainly can. They will sort of form a matrix of dead plant stems over the soil surface, which will help control weeds. You do want to be careful, though, if it's a plant that you don't want to drop seed everywhere. You'll need to make sure that you trim off the seed heads before you, you know, let those clippings lie in the garden. But you certainly can do that. I mean, that's sort of how a meadow or, right, a native planting, roadside planting works, right? That nobody comes through there and cuts the plants down and hauls the debris off to the compost pile, right? The plants sort of naturally drop themselves. The stems kind of break off in the wintertime, and then they're left to lay on the soil. And you definitely can do that. Eventually, it's all going to rot down, decompose, and add nutrients and organic matter to the soil. So it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And you could take those materials and move them to your vegetable garden and lay them down in the vegetable garden. And I think Barbara may have been asking about that as well.
Gotcha. Yeah, you certainly can do that. I don't see why you wouldn't. Again, unless it is a plant that is going to seed everywhere, or it's one that tends to form roots along the stems and spreads that way, then you definitely want to avoid it. So like a mint plant, right? Which if the stem isn't completely dead, you cut that off and lay it down in your vegetable garden, there's a chance it could root. So you definitely don't want to use those types of plants in that situation. But I see no reason why you couldn't with something like the anise hyssop that she mentioned in her email.
Phil in Mount Horeb, we turn to you now. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I have an interest in deterring what I consider to be the big three, which are mice, rabbits, and deer, from my garden and from my orchard area as well. I'd like to surround the areas with a pest inhibitor set of plants that would deter those three. I also, in this mix, have beehives, And I would love to know if there are any of those pest deterring plants that would help get my honey flow going.
Gotcha. Really good question. You know, yeah. Mice and rabbits and deer, they all have very different eating habits. They obviously are different statures as well. So the mice, something really low to the ground versus the deer, which would be something that would be a much higher plant. So there's sort of no one plant that's going to be the magic trick in that situation because they're all very, very different animals with very different habits in the garden. That being said, there's also not a lot of research out there in terms of a plant actually deterring. It's not like a deer is going to walk up to a plant and go, oh, I'm leaving this house because I don't like this plant. What we do with deer is we plant plants that are unpalatable to them, so things that they don't prefer to eat. And same thing with rabbits. It's not that it, you know, there's kind of this old wives' tale of, you know, if you plant marigolds, it's going to deter rabbits. Well, I can tell you that there have been many, many times where I've actually seen the rabbits eating the marigolds in the garden. So that's sort of an old wives' tale, right? There's no science to back that up. So it's not that there's going to be a particular plant that's going to deter. We want to choose things that are plants that are resistant to their feeding habits. So in the case of deer and rabbits, that really tends to be plants that have a very high essential oil content, very fragrant foliage, and also fuzzy leaves. So things like Russian sage or Porovskia, that's a really good one for both deer and rabbit resistance. The Anise hyssop, which was mentioned by the last person's email, very highly, you know, high essential oil content in the leaves and very, very fragrant foliage. Lavender would be another one that they tend not to feed on. So those are the kinds of plants that you would want to plant in that area because they're not welcoming. They're not going to eat them. It's not that they're going to chase them away. It's more that they're not going to fall prey to them.
Phil, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Cindy in New Berlin, we go to you now. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Excuse me. This is a question that I'm sure you've heard a lot over the years, and I don't know if there's much help for it, but is there any way I can amend my soil? My garden has black walnut trees that are affecting it, and nothing really grows except for my garlic and onions.
Yeah. There are solutions.
Yeah, so, yep. There are. Go ahead, Larry. You start with your suggestions first.
Well, raised beds are the first thing that comes to my mind.
That was going to be mine.
then you could just go right ahead and talk about it, Jessica.
Well, raised beds are great. You know, they're really, in terms of growing vegetables, they're really probably the most effective way. Although the juglone doesn't only come from the roots of a black walnut tree. It also comes from the walnuts themselves, from the leaves that fall down on the garden. So even if you do raised beds, you still are going to perhaps have the allelopathic effects of the juglone in those raised beds simply because of what comes down from the tree. So that's going to be a challenge. It's going to be, you know, a little bit harder to overcome. Certainly if you do raised beds, you're going to want to put something in the bottom of the raised bed. So normally I say, you know, have a bottomless raised bed because, you know, you want that water to drain, you want everything to kind of flush through, but with black walnuts, you would want to put something at the bottom of that raised bed to keep the roots from coming up into the nice fluffy soil of the raised bed. So, you know, whether that's, landscape fabric or, you know, a stone bottom or something like that to kind of, or screening, hardware cloth to try to keep those roots from coming up in the beds a little bit. There's certainly also plants. Some plants are more resistant to allelopathic compounds than others. So you can do a little bit of research and look into, you know, what types of plants, you know, vegetable crops in particular are more tolerant of that juglone than others. And there's actually some folks with significant scientific background who really don't believe in the negative effects of juglone at all. You know, there's some interesting studies that look at that say, no, you know, walnut trees don't have a negative effect on soil and on nearby plants growing. So there's like two sides to that coin. But I know that if you grow under black walnuts, as my mom does, I mean, she does have the same issue. She has a lot of struggles with it. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if I believe those other studies. I would want to see those people put a tomato plant down there and tell me that it's not jug lung causing the problem.
Right. And I think, you know, in some cases, it's always hard in scientific studies to sort of mimic every natural environment, right, and home environment. And so they're looking at individual soil samples and everybody's soil is different. And that can certainly impact it as well. So, but it's something I would just suggest you do your research on. Get the raised bed set up if you can, and try to choose plants that are more resistant to it.
And you probably need a pretty good depth for your raised bed as well. I would think you need a foot and a half.
Yeah, you do. I would suggest probably at least 18 inches. For the depth of your raised beds, so that you know you have certainly ample room for the roots to grow of your plants, which is always the case. It doesn't matter whether or not you're near a walnut tree. You still want to have a nice, deep raised bed, if that's at all possible.
Mm-hmm. Take another call. By the way, you can join in. Open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Charlotte in Wisconsin Dells, it's your turn. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, Larry. I love your show. And Jessica, I really appreciate this topic. I have grown in the last year or so a bumper crop of Japanese beetles. And that's not actually something that I was hoping to grow. And so I've been spending about 2 hours a day picking Japanese beetles off the tomatoes and the beans and the potentilla and burning bush and whatever. So I'm wondering what I can do. I have planted marigolds, and they do infest the marigolds, which I feel bad about the marigolds, and I pick them off of them too. But is there anything else that I can do? And I know that they will go away someday. They won't appreciate my hospitality eventually.
Yeah, so Japanese beetles are they're quite a conundrum, right, because they're not a native pest here. So obviously they were imported from Asia, so they don't really have many natural predators that exist here. So they're, although they've been here long enough now that generalist predators like praying mantids and robber flies, you know, those kind of good bugs will eat Japanese beetles. But it's not the same as a pest that is native here that really has a nice sort of group or predators that will attack it and really help manage it in the garden. That's one of the reasons why Japanese beetles can become so problematic. I definitely recommend trying to control them when they are the most vulnerable, which is in their larval state underground, which are those little C-shaped white grubs that you find underneath the ground as you're digging in your soil. You want to control those there. And for that, I recommend using beneficial nematodes, which you actually buy and mix them with water and use a hose end sprayer to apply them to the lawn. And it's a living organism. So these little nematodes, they're microscopic, but they go down into the soil and they actually will wipe out those Japanese beetle grubs. And you do that every spring. You would apply the beneficial nematodes to the spring. So that's what to the soil in the lawn. So that's what I would recommend for controlling the larval state. For the adult state of the Japanese beetles, there's really no like companion plant that's going to absolutely, you know, manage them in the garden and keep them away and deter them from attacking your vegetable plants. I wish there was, but there really isn't. So what I do in my garden is I plant a trap crop. I sort of like what you do with your marigolds, right? You put them in there and they happen to like it, makes them easier to collect. And I do that in my garden. Now, I will give you this, that there is no, this is not a study based. So this is just my experience with this combination. And the Japanese beetles in my garden always go to a plant called Kiss Me Over the Garden Gate, which is an annual plant that's really easy to grow from seed planted directly in the garden. It gets like 5 or 6 feet tall. It has these really cool draping pink flowers. And the Japanese beetles love it above all else in my garden. So if I want to keep them off of my blueberry plants, I will plant a Kiss Me Over the Garden Gate right down the row of my blueberry plants. And that's where they collect. The Japanese beetles much prefer that even to my blueberries. So again, I don't have any research that tells you this. This is what I discovered in my own garden, and that plant partnership really works for me. So that might be something you want to try.
Yeah, worth a shot, Charlotte. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Mike in Lake Mills, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. I just wondered if she could repeat your expert when she said to hold off cleaning out your garden until 5 days, roughly, or a week of 50 degrees. Was that at night or was that during the day?
That is daytime temperatures. Daytime temperatures. So, and, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people are like, what? That's a long time for me to wait to do my spring cleanup. and for gardeners who are itching to get out in their garden in the spring and do that, it does feel like a long time. However, it's also a great reason, an excuse, basically, to hold off a little bit and to let your garden be a little bit messy and to just hold off. It really is essential because all of these good bugs and pollinators, they spend the winter hunkered down, and that's called diapause for them. For a bear, it's hibernation. For bugs, it's diapause. And so what they're waiting for to come out of that, to wake up out of that, is a combination of a certain temperature combined with day length. And so when we have that sort of a week of 50 and above during the daytime, that usually happens about the same time when the day length gets to be the length that triggers them coming out of this diapause. So that's the cue that we want to look for, that it's time to do the cleanup.
Yeah, and I know what you're thinking, Mike. I'm looking out at my own garden area, and, you know, the flowers are, some of the spring flowers are coming up, peeking up through, but I know I have to leave all that litter there.
Yep.
For probably quite a long time. Looks like we've got some freezing rain in southern Wisconsin coming into the Monday or so. So it's not going to happen yet. So you just kind of have to keep looking at that for a while. Good luck.
And all that debris is actually also really a great insulator for the soil and for the roots of your perennials and bulbs that are growing in that space, and the shrubs as well. So it acts as an excellent, you know, sort of insulator. And I know what people say, because this is what I used to say myself, right? You would say, oh, well, nothing's going to come up through all of that debris. It's going to stunt the growth of my plants. And it doesn't. Nobody cleans up the woods and the plants come up through that. Nobody cleans up a meadow or a prairie and the plants still manage to make their way up through that debris. So we sort of have to get over the notion that we always need to help nature along, when in fact nature does just fine on its own.
Thanks again, Mike. Jessica Walliser, our guest today. Her new book is called Plant Partners. Subtitle is Science-Based Companion Planting Strategies for the Vegetable Garden. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jessica Walliser, author of many books and blogs and everything else. She's very active, got her own radio show. The title of her latest book, though, is Plant Partners, Science-Based Companion Planting Strategies for the Vegetable Garden. And let's callers on, a few callers. You could join in, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Marsha in West Salem, your turn. Hi, Marsha.
Hi. Hi. I thank you for taking my call, and great show today. I have a question regarding cover crop of winter rye, the cicale cereal, that we planted last year in an effort to decrease weeds and improve our soil, but we're trying to use no-till. And so in an effort to do that, we were wondering about smothering that crop. Now it's probably, you know, it's a few inches high now and very green. And then when it dies, to be able to, it's going to be tomatoes this year, to plant the tomatoes right within it. And just wondered if that was a good idea or what you might suggest.
Question. I'm really glad that you called with this question, because this speaks to the whole topic I was discussing earlier about doing cover crops right, so that you don't end up with problems down the line. rye is actually one of the most challenging cover crops, especially for people who are new to cover cropping. And that's because it can form a really thick mat of roots and a really thick mat of stems. It's also one of those cover crops that will re-sprout if you don't manage it properly. And this is especially important for folks like you and I who are no-till gardeners. If you're a till gardener and you cut that rye down and you till it into the soil, the chances of it going rogue on you are a little bit lower. But if you're no-till and you don't treat it properly, you're going to have rye issues in that bed for the whole rest of the growing season and perhaps even beyond if it goes to seed. So the trick with rye and many other cover crops, especially the grain cover crops, is to cut it down at exactly the right time. If you cut it down too early or try to smother it too early, you're going to end up with it re-sprouting and becoming problematic. If you wait too long, the plant drops seed and it becomes problematic because those seeds sprout all over the garden, right? And it becomes really hard to get rid of. So the goal is to mow down that that crop right when the flowers are developed, but the seeds have not fully formed. And that's the perfect time. And what I do with my rye cover crop is I actually will use a string trimmer to cut it down at ground level. And then I will run that over with my lawnmower, with the mulching mower over the bed. And that will cut that debris into smaller pieces. And then I just sort of leave that sitting on the soil surface. And then I plant the plants right down through it. You do not have to mow it. You could just cut it down at ground level right when it's at that perfect stage and just leave the longer stems lay because they too will do a good job of suppressing the weeds. The only other caveat I would say with using cereal rye is that it is allelopathic. It does have compounds that inhibit especially the germination of crops grown from seed, small seeds in particular. So wherever you use cereal rye, the following year, you don't want to plant any crops that are tiny seeded like radishes or lettuce or something like that. You want to either use big seeded crops like zucchinis and cucumbers or go with transplants into that area.
All right. Some good advice there. Marcia, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Ann in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Thanks. Thank you for this show, and thanks for doing all the research that went into your book. I do have a comment about the Japanese beetles, though. They will feed on geraniums, pelargonium, and they will feed on them like crazy. And then I found piles of dead Japanese beetles under them. Because geraniums contain geraniol. So the person who was asking about what they can use, I asked our state entomologist at the time, Phil Pelletieri, and he's the one who said, yep, they contain geraniol, so they don't repel Japanese beetles, but if you already have them, they feed on it and die. You might have to replace the geraniums, you know, pelargonium, because that's how voraciously they feed on them. But that works. And then I did a little research, and I don't know if they're actual studies, but on university research-based sites, they list the geranium, 4 o'clock, and delphinium as all having those same properties. So I don't know that there's actual studies out there or if it's just observations that they're reporting. And I'd like to know the plant that you named. I've heard of that, but what do you know the botanical name for that?
Yeah, so let me talk about the geraniums first. Yes, they do contain that compound. In particular, it's concentrated in the petals of the flowers. So that's the part of the plant that has the most of that compound in there. What I have read about it, though, is that oftentimes it acts as a paralysis. So it paralyzes the Japanese beetles, but in many cases, it's only temporary paralysis. So you could have these sort of piles or groups of Japanese beetles, but some of them may revive down the line and, you know, a few hours later and come back to life. So it's not necessarily a surefire thing. And of course, you know, there are other plants that they like to feed on, and so they may choose to go to the other plants instead. But yeah, it's interesting. And the belladonna or the delphinium, that's another one. There are certainly lots of plants that have toxic compounds, and who they're toxic to can vary. But the geranium thing is really interesting. If you watch those Japanese beetles and see who might come back to life, it's a pretty cool thing to see. So the plant I was talking about that I use with my blueberry bushes is Kiss Me Over the Garden Gate, and the botanical name is Persicaria orientalis. It's an Asian native plant, so it's not native here. It used to be known as Polygonum oriental, but now it's Persicaria orientalis. Very easy to get seeds of this plant. I think that they have it at Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. They might even have it at Selected Seeds. Kitchen Garden Seeds, I think, might have them. Real easy to plant from seed. The little native bees absolutely love the flowers of this plant in my garden as well. So lots of benefits to planting it, and it's tough as nails.
Tough as nails. That's good, too. Well, thank you, Ann, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Jerry in Hudson a chance. Jerry, hi. Thank you.
I'm starting a garden. I'm repairing a burn pit, so it'll be like 6 feet in diameter. It's in full sun. It's quite a distance from the house, so I want to put fairly large showy flowers in there. And we have a resident herd of 6 deer. In the middle of the garden, I would like something probably 5-6 feet tall so it shows. And I'd like it to be as long blooming as I can. I know perennials typically aren't real long blooming. And again, I've got the deer problem. And I'd like maybe a blue or purple, like delphinium or something in that category, but, you know, big and showy. Hollyhocks, I don't care. It's something that will work in that area. So any suggestions?
Oh, boy, I have $1 million if I had the plant that fit all of those things, right? To have like a blue-purple flower and deer-resistant and long-blooming period of time all combined together is definitely the holy grail of plants for me in my own garden as well. And you might have to sacrifice one or two of those factors till you find the perfect plant that fits fits all of those things together. And long-blooming is probably going to be one of the ones that stops you, because you're right. At perennials, for the most part, do not have a very long bloom period. So some of them do. So I'm thinking of a great plant for you might be something like the salvias. They're not going to give you the height that you're looking for, but they are deer resistant. They do have that wonderful blue flower. And many of them, if you deadhead them, they do have a really long bloom period. So I would recommend some of those perennial salvias in an environment like that. Let me think what else. Oh, the Porovskia would be another good choice. That's one I recommended to the caller earlier who has deer issues, which is called Russian sage. Again, you're not going to have something quite that high. Another plant that I love, it's not blue, but it's fairly long blooming, and it is, in my garden, deer resistant, and that is Heliopsis. And Heliopsis is sort of like a perennial sunflower. So we have these bright yellow flowers. The pollinators love it, in particular some of our native bees. It's going to be about 4 feet tall. It's pretty late in the season that it blooms, like high summer, you know, July all the way through August. So that would be a good choice for you there as well. Like I said, the deer don't bother it. And then, you know, you might also want to consider adding some annual tropical plants to that place as well. I find the deer don't really, you know, favor them. So maybe like a big red Abyssinian banana or like a Brugmansia to go in there, like an angel's trumpet. That would be really cool. So, or how about like a castor bean? Castor bean, you know, they get really tall. They look really tropical, although they're, you know, they're annual, so you can easily grow them from seed, but they have that sort of big, bold, showy appearance.
Well, you did a pretty good job there, Jessica.
Well, I'm thinking of my own garden because I have so many deer problems as well. And so I'm always rolled through my planting beds in my head. And I think, okay, what has done really well and might fit some of those things she's looking for?
Oh, man. Somebody wondered about aphids in herb plants, you know, wondering where the heck they come from and how do you get rid of them?
So you're not going to like that I'm going to say this, but I actually like having aphids in my garden. And here's why, because if I have aphids, then I also know that I'm going to be supporting a really good population of a whole host of beneficial insects that help keep their numbers in check and also manage a lot of other pests in the garden. So from parasitic wasps to ladybugs and lacewings and all of these other beneficial insects that use aphids as sort of their core solid food group, right? All through the season, they're going to keep those aphids numbers from exploding, and they're going to stick around then to help control other pests in the garden. So for me, I don't necessarily look at aphids as being a bad thing. In fact, on my milkweed plants, I have some swamp milkweed here in the garden, which is very prone to those little yellow oleander aphids. And the stems get absolutely covered with aphids every growing season. And I love when they do because I love to go out there with a little magnifying glass and over the course of a week or two, watch those aphids and see who shows up to eat them. And it has never killed any of the milkweed plants. So you don't have to worry about that.
There you go. Jessica, great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Look forward. I hope we have you back again. Thank you so much. Jessica Walliser, yeah, her new book is Plant Partners, Science-Based Companion Planting Strategies for the Vegetable Garden. After the noon news, we'll be talking about growing your own spices, no matter where you live. If you're listening on Saturday, go to WPR.org/Larry and listen there.